May it please the court.
Please.
Sean McElframe for the state of Missouri. This case presents, I think, two important questions. The first, the primary question, is what is the scope of the state's duty to search out information after a discovery request has been made? And second, and I think this question is ancillary to the first question, given the posture of this case, is what is the degree of proof, or who bears the burden of proving a discovery violation in a post-conviction proceeding? And in this case, did the respondent present sufficient evidence to support his claim that there was a discovery violation in this case? As to the first, the evidence in this case is not a case that, scenario that I've run across before. In this case, in the initial investigation of this case, one of the detectives ran a criminal search on the victim in this case based on the allegation from the respondent that she was a prostitute. That detective, a couple of years before trial, found no evidence of any criminal history. Then leading up to trial, there was a request for the criminal history of this victim. And the state, according to the evidence presented at the evidentiary hearing, did a search, tried to find whether there was anything that was going on, any kind of criminal history, found nothing. The defense attorney also, as part of preparing for trial, tried to find any criminal history of this victim, found nothing. And so the evidence shows that prior to trial, there were three independent searches of this particular witness's criminal background, and nobody turned up anything.
We, in fact, don't have any evidence in this record as to what the state did at that time, though. No record evidence was presented as to where the state looked or if it searched under aliases and so forth.
Well, we don't have a complete record of what they did, but we have the prosecutor's statements on the record, and we have the prosecutor's investigator who testified at the evidentiary hearing and said that they would have followed their normal practice of running everyone.
But the alias issue, as I understand, was not at all clear that they even ran those.
The investigator said he wasn't 100% sure whether he had checked for aliases, but then he said, but it's my normal practice to run everyone.
Did he admit that he knew their aliases, but just couldn't remember whether he had ran them or not?
That's correct.
Was it a normal practice at that time also to check other jurisdictions, like adjoining states?
I don't think there was any evidence about checking adjoining jurisdictions, but there was evidence that what they would do is they would run it through computerized databases. Now, some computerized databases, the NCIC database, for example, is a national database and collects information from many sources. So the evidence was simply that they ran it through the computerized databases that they had access to. Now, there wasn't a particular check, for example, in Illinois, if there was something.
Because I'm concerned your brief seems to suggest if we found this was inadequate here, we would be saying people have to check 50 state databases and every place in any state. But, I mean, I live in Kansas City, and the state line is just a road, and lots of things are across the state line, and saying you need to check the adjoining areas is very different than saying you need to check Nevada or Utah or Massachusetts.
Yeah.
So there's something in between, and your brief doesn't really address that.
Well, and to the extent that I wasn't explicit about that, I hope that some of the citations to the federal cases I have in there will address that, if not directly, at least obliquely, and by reading through them and looking at the way that this issue has been handled in other jurisdictions. I think that it might be reasonable, for example, in the city of St. Louis, or maybe even St. Louis County, or in Jackson County, to expect a prosecutor to take a look and say, well, do we have something in our neighboring jurisdiction? It might be reasonable to do that, just given the proximity and given the fact that, for example, in St. Louis, many people might pass over the state line without in their everyday, normal, daily affairs. They might commit crimes over here. They might commit crimes over here.
I mean, there's 500,000 people.
Sure.
They come for jobs across, it may not be a road, this little river called the Mississippi, to work in St. Louis and St. Louis area, and they go back again over the bridge.
Right, and I think that in some circumstances we might say, well, okay, if a prosecutor failed to in the city of St. Louis failed to do a check of the neighboring county, for example, I think we first have to ask ourselves how reasonable is that, how cooperative is the neighboring county? I don't know. There's no evidence in this record. How easy would it be to check?
But to define the SMSA is St. Louis, Madison County, St. Clair County, St. Louis County, Franklin County. The SMSA, for all purposes regarding metropolitan area, is defined with about 5 or 7 counties in Illinois as part of the same metropolitan area. It seemed to be logical to look into the metropolitan area, because that's why they have a metropolitan area, because of the free flow of people back and forth.
Right, and I guess the difficulty with something like this is, you know, at what point do we require the prosecutor or the prosecutor investigator to leave the office, to leave the computerized databases that are available, and go next door and start sorting through?
Well, they found this in the computer. Manually. They didn't look through the records and look through pieces of paper. They found the three shoplifting charges on computer. No one went over to Illinois and searched them out.
Right, they did. They found it through a computerized search. And the only thing that was shown to be different, definitively in this case, was the prosecutor's switch from one computerized database to a newer computerized database.
Well, what about if we just look to our own rule as to what's required? The rule says any record of prior convictions of persons the state intends to call as a witness at a hearing or trial. So it's pretty clear that the burden is on the state to find any convictions if they are in fact out there.
And I agree. And the defense made a request under the rules saying give me these prior convictions. But there comes a point where I think a line must be drawn where we say this prior conviction was not in the possession of the state. Now, certainly within the bounds of Missouri, it might be more reasonable to say, look, anything that's happened in Missouri, you better find out about it. But at some point, a prosecutor, for example, in Missouri shouldn't necessarily have to find the example earlier.
Missouri has 7 borders. Missouri is the state with the most borders of any state in the United States.
True.
And so you would imagine these borders, most of them not being the Mississippi River, would be porous and
true,
people going back and forth.
But here,
we're dealing with the trial court found the state failed to act reasonably, where it's not the other way, where the trial court did not find it. Didn't the trial court failed in its discovery applications under Brady, so it failed to use reasonable efforts under Brady?
Well, I don't think that the trial court made that finding. I think the court expanded the duty under Brady and said they should have searched without ever saying that the prosecutor's efforts were unreasonable. In fact, to the contrary, I think the motion court indicated that it wasn't saying that the state acted in bad faith.
No suggestion of bad faith at all, but that's a different issue.
And perhaps that is a different issue, but there's, you know, the question of whether there's evidence that's within the possession of the prosecutor, whether that's, hypothetically, if you have evidence that the prosecutor has in hand,
sure.
Doesn't matter, bad faith, good faith, if you don't disclose that in its material, well, you're in trouble.
But now, there's nothing in the rule, though, that limits the responsibility to the prosecuting attorney to what's in his file.
I suppose that's true, that there's nothing in the rule, except that I think it would create an untenable situation for prosecutors to be faced with having to turn over information that they do not possess and that cannot reasonably be found.
But reasonably is key here, and you're you're saying reasonably means if I look in Missouri, that I've done what's reasonable, and couldn't a trial court find that's not, or couldn't this court find that's not reasonable?
Right, and let me point you to one of those cases I cited in my brief, United States versus Perdomo, where where the prosecutor in that case did a search, but apparently only searched the NCIC database, and the court said, well, under these circumstances, we don't think just searching the NCIC database is sufficient. It was merely a token search. And the reason we say that is because this prosecutor didn't search the local Virgin Island records. And the local Virgin Island records are not tied into NCIC. The prosecutor should have known that and should have done the additional search of the local Virgin Island records. I think similar rules could be crafted here, where the rule is something along the lines of, if a prosecutor takes reasonable steps to obtain readily ascertainable information, then the prosecutor has fulfilled the... Pardon me.
I'm sorry, but in this case, you had a trial judge and you had 3 judges in the Court of Appeals. One of them was Judge Mooney, who spent his entire career as a prosecutor, who would understand, I would think, he did not dissent. Understand what's reasonable, not reasonable for a prosecutor.
Well, and I think that Judge Mooney, and I hate to speculate on exactly why they did what they did beyond the opinion that they issued, which is no longer precedential value. But I think that, you know, this motion court, the question is whether, at this point, is whether the motion court clearly erred in its ruling, as it did. And in our view, this motion court has expanded Brady and the discovery obligations to the point where a prosecutor would be liable for any prior conviction so long as it exists in the hands of government personnel.
Well, the trial court, it was actually a factual finding, though, wasn't it? You're suggesting that his finding that the search in this case wasn't reasonable elevates it to some sort of legal status. Fact is, I mean, he just made a factual finding that what the prosecutor did in this case was not reasonable.
Well, again, I can't say that I agree that the trial court made a finding that what the prosecutor did was unreasonable.
Well, don't we generally assume if there wasn't that the factual findings are made in accordance with the trial court's judgment?
No, not in a 2915 motion. I don't think the court ever implies factual findings for the motion court. I think that those findings have to be there, and we question whether they're clearly erroneous or not. The trial court here merely said, well, we don't know what happened. Well, if we don't know what happened, it's because the respondent failed in his burden of proof.
No, but what they said you didn't know, I mean, the respondent has a burden, but once the respondent has shown a Brady violation, shown that potentially exculpatory evidence or impeachment evidence was not turned over, and the question is, the reasonableness of your search, how can it be respondent's burden to show it was in your file? I mean, the state's the one who has possession of what's in the prosecutor's file. At that point, wouldn't the burden of going forward at least have to shift to the state to show what they did and that it was reasonable for them not to come up with what clearly existed but was not produced?
No, I don't think it does. I think the burden under Rule 2915 always remains.
So not the burden of moving going forward. Once they show there were convictions out there at the time which you failed to disclose, why isn't that enough? And then you've got to come up and say, yeah, but what we did was reasonable. It's reasonable that we didn't disclose them.
Because Rule 2915 says that the movement bears the burden of proving his claims by a preponderance of the evidence.
Why haven't they done that by showing there were convictions out there in the system that were not disclosed, in the absence of your showing some reason for that?
Well, and I think that we did show some reason for that, which was that the prosecutor was using a different search engine. The prosecutor was using an updated method of doing computerized searches. But I think really the question is, and I think there was an opportunity to do this at one point. You know, the respondent's counsel asked the investigator, well, do you have the prior runs in the file? And he said, well, let me look. But then before he could answer, he said, well, let me ask you a different question. And it was never established what was in the prosecutor's file. Now, the prosecutor doesn't have a burden to go forward and say, well, you know, we didn't commit a discovery violation. It certainly can if it wants to. And I think it'd be a good idea in any given case. But the defendant bears the burden under 2915. He should have alleged and proved sufficient facts.
Let me ask you a very, very practical question as it relates to the rules of discovery and application of this specific rule regarding a record of prior convictions. Because of what a prior conviction would be used for, which would be credibility determinations, presumably that's why it's there. Isn't there a burden on the state to do it shortly before the trial of the case?
To do a check for criminal record?
Shortly before the trial of the case, because you know, some of these cases aren't tried for at least a year.
Sure.
And to require otherwise, a very practical matter, would be to give prosecutors an incentive to run the record at the time of the arrest and never check it again.
Right.
Which clearly that's not what the rules intended to do.
No, because under Brady, the state has a continuing discovery obligation. And so right up to the time of trial, and realistically, or I guess the best practice would be to go and run them again right before trial, the day before trial. And I suspect many prosecutors do because they don't want to be stunned later on. There wasn't any evidence of the timing of the checks that were run by the prosecutor in this case immediately before trial. Just merely that they were run before trial. But again, I think that's a failure in the evidence that should be, that the respondent should be held accountable for failing to carry his burden.
Isn't it significant that what the real question is it's not just what's in the prosecutor's possession, but it's what's in a state agent's possession, and the term government's being used instead of state, but But as you've indicated, there is some expansion of that, but it's always been not any government anywhere, but it had to be in possession of the state that was prosecuting.
And if you look at the cases, they mostly, that's what they talk about. And there's very little case law, at least that I could find, from the U.S. Supreme Court defining the boundaries of Brady. But in Powles versus Whitley, they did say anybody working in the case, including the police. But then other cases have said, for example, in a federal case, that if there was information held by the United States Post Office, that the federal government couldn't say, well, Post Office has it, we can't get it.
Well, but the Post Office is still the same
part
government
of the,
as
yes.
the federal government.
And so
we're talking about the government of a separate state.
Yeah, and that I think is important as well.
So are you saying there's no obligation now to look in Illinois or Kansas?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that there's probably it's probably much harder for a prosecutor to find everything that exists in every state, but that shouldn't exempt a prosecutor for running reasonable checks through computerized databases that prosecutors have access to, which can pull up information from Nevada, Utah, Illinois.
Why do you think it's hard? I mean, databases are created every day. Google, I mean, I wouldn't be on Google, but these databases the FBI has are probably much more exhaustive than maybe 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
Right, and that's why I think that this case is important as well, because as technology advances and as more and more jurisdictions automate, cases like this, I think, are bound to come up, where there's been a reasonable and a good faith effort to find information so that it could be disclosed according to the demands of Brady and our discovery rules, but where, because time had passed and something had changed, this information suddenly became available to the state.
And what's significant here is defense counsel ran a search as well before trial and didn't find it.
I do believe that's significant.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
If it pleases the court, nothing that Judge Grady did broke any new ground. Nothing he did expanded the rule of Brady. He simply attempted to correct what he believed was a verdict conviction that we could no longer have any confidence in.
Did this crime was committed in the city of St. Louis?
It was.
All right. So was it deficient then of the state not to check right across the river into Illinois about criminal convictions there? I mean, was the technology available at that time for the state to have done that?
Absolutely. As the judge indicated, Judge Mooney was first assistant for Buzz Westphal for many years. When he was in the office, they simply call it a Hoover sheet. When I was in law school, an intern in the office, it was a Hoover sheet would print out all over the United States. But the technological issue is the dog ate my homework. They had the evidence in their possession. They simply had to ask the witness, have you used any other names? Have you ever pled guilty to a crime? You don't have to go to a database. You don't have to go to a computer. You simply ask the witness. The witness is in your possession.
But the conviction the conviction was in Illinois. Was
Sangamon County in Springfield, yes.
Yeah, was that under her alias or was that under her real name?
At the time that she made the complaint, she was going as Tamika Brown. At the time she came to trial, she identified herself as Tamika DeVold. The convictions in Sangamon County, the three convictions from the 90s, she is Tamika DeVold, and she is Nikki Brown, and she's Tamika Brown. So she has used aliases in the state of Illinois. In the state of Missouri, in St. Louis County, the 21st Circuit, she is using the name Tamika DeVold. So the different names are known to the prosecutor. Mr. Schaefer, who ran the record check, and we'll address that later on, what he indicated was this. He was uncertain if he ran aliases, and what he thought was he only ran Regis. He acknowledged that they had access to Mules and NCIC. I asked the court to go back to respondent's appendix at the appellate court that the records from Illinois, what they indicate. That Detective Schaefer, Investigator Schaefer, says, I did not have a SID number or an FBI number to run her, but the sheets that are provided to me on the morning of the hearing clearly indicate that there's a SID number, clearly indicate there's an FBI number.
Can't they get Social Security? Can't they get fingerprints at all, or can they require fingerprints?
Well,
or?
As a matter of practicality, they don't do it. They're not going to print their own witnesses.
If this crime had been committed in Newton County, would it have been reasonable for the prosecutor to have searched the records of Illinois?
The dark truth is, Judge, I don't think the records were ever searched. If you ran NCIC and if you ran Mules, you'll very, very clearly see that this is a Mules record. This conviction in Illinois, you picked up on Mules. We didn't pick it up on any elaborate new system that Ellie Webb. Regis remained constant. Mules remained constant. NCIC remained constant. You asked about the defense counsel. All we have access to at that time was Regis, which can tell us what's open, at least as for St. Louis County and St. Louis City, what's an open file and what's a prior conviction. We don't, that Regis that we get to run, that we pay a service for, we don't access outstate.
Are there cases saying that if defendant didn't find something, then it's reasonable for the prosecution not to have found it? Or do they have a higher burden?
The defendant doesn't have the resources to do it. In U.S. v. Auten from the Fifth Circuit, where they talk about it, there's a conversation, or the court opines that the government has a wealth of data that they can retrieve. The defense lawyer simply does not. We have faced that now, in fact, and our Regis is limited.
It is your burden of proof here to prove, error to prove this failure to turn over this material was prejudicial, isn't it?
Well, there's no question it was prejudicial. And Judge Grady so found, because he made that determination both as to her prior three convictions, and he made a determination that her three pending fraudulent use of credit card cases may also be admissible, would have changed the verdict.
The parties seem to disagree. Everybody agrees she had convictions. They were not, information about them was not provided to defense counsel, so it wasn't available for cross-examination and impeachment. But the question seems to, parties seem to differ on who has the burden of showing reasonableness or lack of reasonableness or what the prosecutor did and whether it met a reasonableness standard. Can you address that?
Yeah, well, reasonable is just what I indicated. Ask the witness. Is that
Well, say the witness lies. Then is that reasonable? Is that all the prosecution has to do? Is it rely on the witness?
It's one thing to ask the witness. I mean, before, at some point between when Brady was decided and the advent of computer databases, where we wouldn't be able to access it on a computer, we might simply just have to ask the witness.
But once you have shown a failure to turn over evidence, is it your burden to prove that any reasonable search by the prosecutor would have turned it up, or once you show it's there in a database, is it their burden to prove what they did was reasonable and they just didn't discover it? How do we clear the investigator said he didn't find it and he did a search. We don't know what he did.
Right.
Who should we lay at fault the fault to for not knowing what in fact really was done?
Well, as His Honor indicated, the rule places the burden on the state to use to make a diligent effort to discover it. The Cowles versus Whitley indicates that they have an affirmative duty to do so. The court recognized that of the four counts of the indictment against Mr. Merriweather, he was found not guilty of three of them, and the court decided and concluded that had defense counsel had the convictions, he may in fact have been able to persuade the jury as to that fourth count, and the defendant would have been acquittal on all.
Is that is that a legal determination or a factual determination?
Of what? Of
the prejudicial nature of the convictions.
I think it's both.
The state, I think, is concerned that we'd be creating a slippery slope here if we said that the state had to go beyond looking at Regis, at Missouri's databases or the FBI databases, and pretty soon they have to look at every pot, you know, keep up with the technology. If there's anything new, they're going to have to start checking it. Is that what would happen here?
Well, I went to trial 2 weeks ago. They had no problem finding the defendant's Texas priors. I mean, they were certainly
there. But that's now. I mean, are we going to judge in hindsight what was reasonable at the time by looking at what we can do 3 or 4 or 5 years later?
In 2005, when this trial was held, We haven't seen any marginal leap in our ability to retrieve records. You know, all the evidence was that we went to a different system. There was no indication by the testimony of Detective Schaefer that this is a new technology, that we have new entries. These convictions are entered into FBI databases, which are then entered into the NCIC database. Her prior convictions have an FBI number, which means it's a national database. It's not particular to Illinois. It's not particular to Sangamon County. It is a national database. That's why they call it, that's what the N stands for, a national.
And but certainly there are errors in putting information into the database.
Of course there are.
And so are you saying under the facts of this case, we can't assume there was an error in Illinois entering the data and that's why it wasn't found?
Well, if you look at the Exhibit A and Exhibit B from the motion hearing, which are the records from that were retrieved pursuant to MULES, pursuant to NCIC, go through it. See what's entered. See the date of the entries. It wasn't like that she pled guilty in 1990, 1994, 1997, and they just got entered in the 2007, 10 years later. They were entered then.
And the record
and the records reflected. And, you know,
you found it. You found it as the defense counsel.
No, I didn't find that. That was provided to me on the date of the hearing.
Okay.
Because there was a request that the court would order an NCIC, a MULES check, and their Regis check, because I don't have that access. And in the Cribbins case, of which we cite, and both Judge Gray cites and Judge Baker cites, there is a request by counsel that the court direct the government to run this check as to the name, and also talk about as to aliases, because that was an alias case, the Cribbins case, and the court there, the Seventh Circuit, said that, you know, because there were aliases, would not excuse their inability to determine, because they were talking about the Chicago Police Department couldn't find these records.
What makes the pending cases in St. Louis, I think, county, what makes them admissible?
Well, if I may preface as the county cases, it is the position of the state that they couldn't find pending cases wherein this witness was warrant in
right,
a sister
but
circuit.
But even if that is a given.
It would be a decision for the trial court to look at what I would suggest would be the informations in that case, what was the information that was filed in St. Louis County, and determine whether that information would allow defense counsel to ask her about those pending cases for number of reasons.
Only you can only impeach with convictions. So how do you?
Well, you can impeach with prior bad conduct. You could show that she was warned at the time of her testimony. You could ask whether or not there has been some agreement with her in exchange for a testimony that they might contact the prosecutor's office in St. Louis County. There is a number of ways that those pending cases could be subject to a cross-examination. But it would be for the trial court to make that determination.
It'd be for the record for us to see whether they were admissible.
Well, Judge Grady thought they were. In Judge Grady's opinion, he thought...
And what's in the record that supports that is what I'm saying.
Of the trial record itself?
Of the motion record.
Of the motion record, nothing.
Well, was he basing his decision on the fact that they would be admissible based upon the type of case? In other words,
yes.
It wasn't a pending speeding ticket.
Right.
It was a pending...
Fraudulent use of a credit card is
right.
A crime of deception.
A crime of deception. That's why he felt like they would be admissible.
Is there a single authority, book, treatise, publication, that sets out the duties of the state regarding these various databases that say, when you do a search, you shall search this, this, and this?
I'm unaware, but the rule speaks that, you know, they should use due diligence. The law clearly indicates that they have the affirmative duty, but there's been no instruction from, and because each prosecutor's office is their own fiefdom.
Yeah, but if there were a standard, say you always do the NCIC. in Missouri. You always do mules. You always do.
Well, if, if I were invited to the next prosecutor's conference down the lake,
you'd suggest.
I might ask one of them to bring it up.
There's nothing like that now,
not that I'm aware.
And there's no case that up till this point has said
what they should run.
This is what reasonable is.
No. And what do you think reasonable is? If you were writing this opinion, how would you craft reasonable? Or due diligence?
At the bare minimum, as I said, skip the technology. Ask the witness.
And that should be our rule. All you have to do is ask the witness.
It's a starting point. It's a starting point. Ask the witness. And then run your available databases. There are some of the cases that are cited. They talk about in the Jones case, they talk about they ran mules, but they didn't have it. And I'll note that in that Jones case, which I think is trumped by Kyle's now, they discovered the prior conviction by simply asking their witness.
But the state here says they did use the available databases, they just didn't do enough of them. They didn't do one from another jurisdiction. So how do you answer that?
Well, Regis doesn't end at the Missouri border. NCIC doesn't end.
And those were available at the time of this conviction?
Absolutely. The witness clearly indicates, you know, Mr. Schaefer says, we had Regis, we had mules, we had NCIC.
And you said there was an FBI number and a SID number.
There's an FBI number and an SID number in Petitioner's Exhibit A.
How do you get those numbers? Those indicate that you're running these databases, or
they are in Detective Schaefer's testimony. He talks about he could not find a SID number, he could not find an FBI number. That's in his testimony. And these convictions that are printed out clearly indicate there's an SID number, an FBI number.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Zoe has a question.
Well, I was, you know, when you were asked, the rule says any record of prior convictions. So why wouldn't a database be considered in any record?
I mean, run them all.
I mean, it's any available record. I assume if we want to add words to our own rule, we could say any available record. But the rule says any record. I mean,
I'll live with that, Judge.
Okay.
Thank you.
Now, sorry to bother you, but you only have a limited amount of time. I'm following up on Judge Price's questions, which I thought were very good about. Aren't there any best practices? I mean, this is the government. There are training sessions all the time. Wouldn't the state of Missouri or some professional association of prosecutors say these are the prescribed databases to check to follow up on Brady?
Well,
and therefore you'd have a standard that you could rely on.
Yeah, there might be a best practice guide that could be put together on this. I don't know if every prosecutor's office in the state has access to the same databases. I don't know if there are subscriptions that are required. I don't know that. But at the minimum, I think they should run every witness through every database that they have access to. I don't have a problem with that. The prosecutor's recollection was that this witness was run through mules. The investigator's recollection was that they had run through Regis. And just one thing about the fact that there's an SID and an FBI number on the records that were provided to him at the post-conviction hearing. Yeah, there was. That's when we'd found them. Hmm. But there wasn't one when the first check was done. That's what the investigator
did. Right. But just the obligation. You said yourself.
How do we know that?
He testified to it.
Okay.
He said he didn't find them. He didn't find any numbers, but if they're in this, I mean, the cart and the horse, isn't it? I mean,
no, it's not, because the only way you get these numbers is by looking in the system.
Have you proved that they were, so you're saying there's evidence in this record that, in fact, these convictions were not in there and were only added later, or just that he didn't find them?
What I'm saying is that there was not an SID number or an FBI number when they did the first search, according to the investigator's testimony.
Okay, I got a question because it's important to me then. So the guy who says he did the records in this case, the one who testified, does this record include a copy of the exhibits within the record that he obtained at that time?
You mean before trial?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, before trial.
No.
Okay, okay. So there's no, other than his testimony, there's no documentary evidence of what was presented or not presented to the defendant as far as a...
That's right. He was asked, do you have it in your file? He said, let me check. But before he could answer, respondent's attorney cut him off and said, let me ask you something else. If they thought there was an exhibit in the prosecutor's file that needed to be made part of this record, they should have put it in.
Why wouldn't have you wanted it in the record
so that we
could make a determination of whether or not you made a reasonable search?
I'd want it in the record. There's no question about it. If I could have what he ran, I'd want it in the record. But again, that goes back to the other question. Well, whose burden is it to put it in the record? And under the rule, the burden falls upon the defendant. He needs to plead what the prosecutor didn't do, and he needs to prove it. And it might be difficult to do that, but hopefully, as part of the proceeding, the prosecutor's file could be brought into court. The investigator could be asked questions. The investigator could be given the opportunity to say, well, here it is, or here it isn't. And if we don't have it, to let the motion court make a finding, a credibility finding, and say, well, I just don't believe you ran it then.
Well,
for him to stand up here today and say, well, I just think the dark truth is that nobody ran it, goes afoul of the motion court's findings, because the motion court never suggested that it wasn't ran, and in fact said it wasn't run, and said that the prosecution had acted in good faith. Now, if the prosecutor acted in good faith, I think we can retake from what the motion court said that it was run.
Can we take from, well, maybe does the fact that the trial judge found that the prosecutor acted in good faith, does that somehow get imputed to the officer? I mean, was there any finding as to what the officer did in the record below?
Well, I think that the motion court used the word prosecution or state, and I'm not sure if it was intending to refer specifically to the prosecutor or to the investigator, but there was no finding as to the investigator's failures in the attempt to find this either. And I might point out that asking the witness was something that anybody could have done. He deposed him, he had her at trial, and there was no allegation in the motion that the state failed in that regard.
But inadvertent failure, I mean, she had prior convictions, the state didn't reveal it. The question is, why didn't they know? Because the trial court did not find an intentional failure to disclose. You keep putting somehow if it's in good faith, then you win, but that's not the issue. An inadvertent failure to disclose is still a failure to disclose.
I think what I'm saying is not just inadvertent, but a lack of proof that the prosecutor didn't do what it was supposed to do is what I think requires reversal in this case. For all we know, the prosecutor did ask this witness, do you have any priors? And she said no. But there was no allegation in the motion to the contrary, and there was certainly no evidence presented at the hearing.
So you would say it's defendant's burden to prove what the prosecutor did or did not ask the witness?
Yeah, make the allegations, do the investigation, so that you can make the appropriate allegations in your motion, and then find out what the truth is at a hearing. That's why we have these hearings.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.